From Oregon to South Carolina, Arkansas to Massachusetts, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the LaGotham Institute has released its third annual United States Prosperity Index, detailing economic prosperity in the 50 states and Washington, D.C. Sean Flanagan of the Institute is here with details. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is using budget talks for political messaging rather than seriously attempting to craft a spending plan. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Buried deep in the American Rescue Plan is a proposal to essentially do away with independent tax preparers. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Ben Albin from the Institute for Justice. And when the left calls for defunding the police, they mean exactly that, a complete defunding of law enforcement. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Each year, the London-based LaGotham Institute conducts a study of economic prosperity in the 50 states and the District of Columbia, compiled into the United States Prosperity Index. The 2021 study has been published, and Sean Flanagan is here with the details. Sean is Director of Impact and Partnerships at the LaGotham Institute. Sean, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Sean, before we get into the specifics of the report, tell us a bit about it, some background history. What information is the report intended to impart to folks?
Our global prosperity index that we've been producing every year for the past 15 years, tracking it and measuring prosperity around the world, shows that overall the U.S. performs consistently well. It ranks 18th across all the different pillars and domains of prosperity. And actually on the economic domains, it always ranks in the top 10. It's currently ranking 7th, so it does very strongly. But when you look at the other aspects of prosperity, it doesn't perform as well, particularly on safety and security and health, and we wanted to understand why. So we set about creating the United States Prosperity Index, which measures how that prosperity distributes across the 50 states of the Union and also across 1,196 counties across 12 selected states.
I would be interested in knowing, Sean, what countries rate at the top of that index if the United States comes in 18th?
Consistently, we find that the Nordic states perform well. They perform well across all the 12 pillars of prosperity within the global index. So that's the likes of Finland, Sweden, Norway generally do well. But you also find the United Kingdom is up at around 10th. So it's those kind of states and countries, nations that are at the top.
You mentioned the pillars of economic prosperity, and now speaking specifically about the United States Prosperity Index, Sean, what are some of those pillars that you look at? What metrics do you use to develop this report?
So the index is a little bit like a pyramid. At the apex, you've got overall prosperity. Underneath that, you've got three domains, inclusive societies, open economies, and empowered people. Then you have the pillars. And in the inclusive societies, we're capturing here things around like safety and security, personal freedom, governance. The open economies domain looks at the business environment, infrastructure for businesses to start and to flourish. And then in the empowered people, we look at things like health, education, living conditions. And then underneath that, we have, in the US index, we have 48 policy-focused elements. So within education, to say a state is performing well or not so well on education isn't necessarily that helpful. But so we break it down into the different stages of education because we believe that that's most useful for policymakers. And then for each of those 48 elements, we have a basket of 4 to 8 indicators, and they are measures which combined best proxy those 48 elements.
This is your third annual report that is focused on the United States specifically. Sean, we've obviously had this COVID-19 pandemic. It has impacted pretty much every area of society. What does this year's report show? Are a lot of these indices down as a result of the pandemic?
So yes, absolutely. The latest year between 20 and 21, we see a downtick in U.S. prosperity. But we also see, prior to the pandemic, year on year, a steady increase in U.S. prosperity. And we believe that positions the U.S. well to perform strongly as it emerges on the other side of the pandemic. And in fact, lately, we've seen new business applications in the latter half of 2020 and also continuing up until middle of 2021, continuing to rise. And 2020 was the biggest year on record. So that bodes really well for an economic recovery. But obviously, many other aspects of society, as you said, have been impacted. It's not just the economy. It's not just health. It's education. It's also relationships. Mental health has also been further exacerbated.
Taking a look then at the individual states, because you do rank and you do a study of all 50 states plus the District of Columbia. Sean, tell us which states are performing the best on the U.S. Prosperity Index.
Similarly, with the previous 2 years, we find that the northeastern states generally are at the top. So we have Massachusetts and Connecticut, New Hampshire. And then at the bottom, we have the sort of more of the southeastern states, so likes of Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, that don't perform so well. But we do see other states outside of the northeastern states doing well. So we have Minnesota, we have Utah, and Washington state all perform well. So it's not just unique to the northeastern states. Some other states outside also perform well.
Is there any common thread among the states that do perform well that put them up at the top of the ranking?
I think on the empowered people domain, they often perform well on those pillars. When you look at inclusive societies and open economies, it's a bit more of a mixed picture. So I would say the empowered people pillars is where those northeastern states probably do better than others.
In a number of states, you have drilled down to the county level. What made you decide to go that far down in terms of being able to take these pillars and quantify the economic progress of those counties? Why down to the county level, Sean?
Some of the states, when you look at the likes of California and Texas and Florida, you know, these are very large states with very populous. And in fact, if California were to be a nation, it would rank fifth, I believe, globally with its economic output. And so we really wanted to understand how prosperity distributes, not just across the United States, but also within a state. And when we look at the 12 states that we've surveyed, we see that prosperity distributes very differently. So in California, you find those counties that are in or around the Bay Area do well. But when you look at the northern counties, they rank towards the bottom of the county index. So there's a huge disparity in prosperity. And that kind of information, we believe, is really useful for policymakers, because it helps deliver more targeted policies at the local level.
Has this report been able in any way to capture the impact, and the impact is still unfolding, of the American Rescue Plan, Sean, and the fact that there's been a record amount of borrowing and essentially printing of money? Is this seen as a potential drag on future economic recovery and prosperity?
Well, I think, you know, increasing national debt is never really a good thing. But obviously, at times of pandemic, countries such as the US and UK are able to do that. But I think key is to get the economy going. And as I mentioned earlier, the new business applications are crucial to that. You know, to really get entrepreneurship dynamism going is crucial to getting the economy moving. And when we saw how strongly the US recovered post-financial crisis at the end of the noughties, we believe that the U.S. is positioned well, again, drawing upon the strengths before the pandemic to help it emerge more strongly. But there are some other challenges that need to be addressed, and we highlight those in the report as well.
We have been talking with Sean Flanagan. He is Director of Impact and Partnerships at the LaGotham Institute. We've been discussing the 2021 United States Prosperity Index, which has just been released by the Institute. Sean, tell us a bit about the LaGotham Institute, and also this report obviously has a lot of information, a lot of data. Where can folks go on the web to get it?
All the information is publicly available. It's on the website www.usprosperity.net. The LaGotham Institute is a London-based think tank, but with a global remit. And our mission is about helping to create the pathways from poverty to prosperity so that everybody can lead a flourishing life.
Sean Flanagan of the LaGotham Institute. Sean, thank you for taking time to be here.
Thank you, Lerman.
At the Club for Growth, Scott Parkinson is standing by after keeping an eye on all the activities of Congress before their summer recess. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me, Lohman.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of course, queuing up some talking points for her members over the August recess, this with an appropriations bill that pretty much a show bill. So tell us a bit about it.
recently, Nancy Pelosi propounded a partisan bloated bus appropriations bill on the House of Representatives. The massive appropriations bill actually funded Democrats' socialist wish list of policies that would be detrimental to our country. And she brought forward 7 separate subcommittee appropriations bills and lumped them all together in what Republican leadership ended up calling this bill was the bloated bus. This is a bill that received 0 Republican votes in the Appropriations Committee when they voted each of the bills out, which is pretty unique when it comes to an Appropriations Committee because generally that committee is seen as very bipartisan when it comes to spending taxpayers' precious dollars. And so Pelosi brought forward a big partisan massive appropriations bill, and it did all sorts of outrageous things in terms of federal funding. It broke big, big precedents when it comes to the Hyde Amendment and federal funding for abortion. It also funds critical race theory in higher education, which teaches students that people are racist based on skin color only and that America is a racist country. And it also even defunded school choice by defunding federal funds for charter schools. Charter schools are obviously seen in many urban communities and other communities as a destination for K through 12 education for students that are trapped in really dead-end situations with terrible schools. And so Democrats have looked at what happened over the coronavirus pandemic, and they know how this issue is resonating with conservative voters, but what are they going to do? They're going to protect their progressive base, the teachers' unions, and the educational institutions that are honestly failing our students. And this legislation would have dramatically cut federal funding for charter schools throughout America. It would have affected 3.3 million students in America, and quite honestly, Club for Growth, through our 501c4 doing issue advocacy, strongly opposed this legislation. On the other hand, on August 1st, the debt limit suspension expired. And so what did House Democrats do for the last 2 years when they had their majority? They didn't care about the debt limits expiring. They didn't offer any solutions to our nation's debt and deficit problem. Instead, they propounded this massive appropriations bill. Now, the Club for Growth, we called on members of Congress to refocus their legislative efforts toward a positive economic growth agenda that would unleash economic opportunity through decreasing anti-competitiveness through excessive regulation, would reduce the overtaxation of individuals and businesses, and promote free markets. We think that Congress needs to pass a balanced budget amendment that would ensure that the next debt limit increase is the last debt limit increase. And a balanced budget amendment is an idea that Congress would need to pass and send to the states to amend our U.S. Constitution. But it's something that has been a topic of conversation when it comes to our fiscal woes for more than a generation. And we've just quite honestly never gotten it done. So Congress also needs to end those expanded federal unemployment benefits that discourage a return to work. And we need to allow for a full reopening of the U.S. economy. Instead, recently, Nancy Pelosi is bringing back the mask mandate in the House of Representatives. You've got continued guidance from the Center for Disease Control telling folks that they need to be terrified of the new variants of the coronavirus. The bottom line is, I think everybody's learned a lot over the last 18 months in terms of which states had draconian lockdowns and which states mostly offered freedom. And this is the difference between states like Florida and states like New York and New Jersey. This is the difference between California and Montana. We want to support freedom, and we want to also support public safety when it comes to our nation's health. But individuals, local communities need to be making those decisions. And, you know, the Club for Growth would certainly oppose a continued or additional lockdown of the U.S. economy. This idea that Democrats are out there and they're stoking fear. They're telling everybody that they need to be concerned about more deadly variant outbreak throughout the country, and really the data is not showing that.
As all of this plays out, Scott, and you had this show bill that was put out by Speaker Pelosi before Congress adjourned for its recess, we do have a budget deadline coming up on October 1st. Is there any realistic and serious effort at trying to meet that deadline for a change?
No, I think that what we're going to see on September 30th and October 1st is late-night negotiations and a breakthrough for what they call a continuing resolution. And a continuing resolution, also known as a CR, will extend current levels of government funding to a certain date. I predict that that date will be in December and that they will set up a massive Christmas list type appropriations bill that also includes an extension of various tax credits that Joe Biden had within his stimulus package. All that stuff is going to come to a T here in December, in my view.
Is there any chance that some amount of fiscal sanity might be injected into the process by Republicans, or given the Republicans' minority status and tied status in the Senate, is it now the situation where the best Republicans can hope for is to maybe knock down some of the more serious and draconian spending that's being proposed?
I would say that it's almost zero. And I hate to say that there's no chance, but it is incredibly unlikely that Republicans will have the political muscle to actually change anything in Washington right now. I've said this for 2 years on your show. Elections matter. We did not win the House in 2018. Pelosi came in and impeached Donald Trump twice. We didn't win the House back in the 2020 elections. We get Joe Biden. We're passing massive stimulus bills. We're doing these bloated bust appropriation bills. They're talking about spending $4.7 trillion on infrastructure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, tell us a bit about the Club for Growth.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization that has several entities underneath our umbrella. Our website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can also become a member for the Club for Growth for free, so check us out on our website.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, talk with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Independent tax preparers could become a thing of the past if a provision in the American Rescue Plan is adopted. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Ben Alban from the Institute for Justice.
Buried inside the American Families Plan is an idea to effectively apply occupational licensing rules to the people that help you with your taxes. And it's one of those things, like many occupational licensing rules, that ultimately mean consumers will pay more and probably have fewer choices for who they go to navigate the ever-increasingly complexity of the federal tax code. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dan Alban. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and he joins us now on the phone to talk about the many, many problems with this idea, just one sort of niche aspect of the American Families Plan. Dan, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Let me start, I guess, with the way the Treasury Department is proposing and the White House is proposing this plan. They say that taxpayers often make use of these unregulated tax preparers who lack the ability to provide accurate assistance, and that these people make costly mistakes that end up hurting consumers, Dan. The White House is just looking out for the average American here, right?
Not exactly. And the characterization of tax preparers as unregulated is completely specious. Tax preparers are already regulated by dozens of federal laws that impose civil and criminal penalties, fines of up to $100,000, prison, injunctions, and some of those are laws that apply specifically to paid tax preparers, including increasing due diligence obligations if they're preparing a return with an earned income tax credit. So these are not unregulated preparers. And they aren't even unregistered preparers. All tax preparers have to register with the IRS to obtain a thing called a P-10, which is essentially an identifying number that identifies every tax preparer. And any preparer that files more than 10 returns has to obtain an EFIN, an e-filing identification number that requires that they pass a suitability check. So they already go through several levels of registration that looks at whether they have suitability, including a criminal background check and various other things, and they're already governed by a number of laws that make it illegal to commit tax fraud or to defraud your clients. So these are not unregulated preparers, and the suggestion by Treasury that they are is completely false. They also don't have a higher error rate than other preparers, as far as we know. Treasury has not publicized any studies suggesting that that's the case. And in fact, the National Taxpayer Advocate, Nina Olson, admitted in a 2013 paper that basically every tax return has errors in it. And that's because the tax code is extremely complex and you can make some underlying errors while preparing the return that ultimately often don't have any effect on the ultimate underlying number that someone owes for their taxes.
This is not a new idea. This is actually sort of resurrecting an idea that was briefly implemented during the Obama administration, then defeated in court. Dan, I'm glad we have you here to talk about this because you were instrumental, actually, in defeating it in court several years ago. This is different because this would be, I guess, Biden, rather, is asking Congress to pass this into law, and that was the big problem last time, right?
That's right. Back about a decade ago, the IRS tried to do this unilaterally without any statutory authorization. And since we challenged that, got it struck down in the D.C. Circuit, the IRS and Treasury and various advocacy groups have been pushing to give IRS the statutory authority to do this. Of course, among those lobbying most for it are the big tax prep firms, including H&R Block and others, who stand to benefit the most by consolidating the market, pushing out independent preparers, and that, you know, gives them a chance to raise their prices, because with fewer preparers in the market, they can command a higher price. And obviously that benefits the big tax prep firms at the expense of the small mom and pop preparers.
We're talking with Dan Albin. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, talking about this proposal just sort of buried deep inside the American Families Plan that President Joe Biden has proposed that would effectively apply occupational licensing rules to people who prepare taxes. Dan, just a minute or so left here. I want to sort of hammer that point that you were just making, which is that this is something that, you know, the big tax preparing firms out there, the H&R Blocks, the TurboTaxes, whatever, they can more easily absorb these additional regulatory costs, right? And that's, I mean, this is the same story we see with occupational licensing of everything from hair braiders to mechanics to whatever you have.
Yeah, that's right. And President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors recognized this in a report they issued about 6 years ago that found that in the vast majority of cases, these occupational licenses just serve to drive up prices for consumers, drive out competition, and benefit the political insiders that lobby for them. And that's exactly what's happened with these tax preparer licensing regulations. They've been lobbied for by groups from the AICPA, the Association of CPAs, to the H&R Block. And the whole purpose behind them is to limit competition so that these organizations can have a larger market share and drive up prices. And of course, that's wrong. It not only makes things worse for consumers, but it pushes a whole bunch of people out of productive jobs that they would have otherwise had. There were hundreds of thousands of preparers making a living who don't have licenses as CPAs or as tax attorneys or as enrolled agents. And if their customers are happy with their performance, they should be able to continue doing so.
Yeah, it seems like it's like we're going to make the tax code more complex, which is something Biden wants to do. And then they're going to use that increased complexity. Oh, there's more tax credits. There's more things in here to justify like even more regulations on the people who actually help everyday Americans navigate that tax code. I don't know. I would rather just see the tax code be simplified. I guess that's probably too much to ask at this point. But that's a whole nother conversation. And we are unfortunately out of time for today. Dan Albin from the Institute for Justice. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
And again, that is Dan Albin, senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. You can check out his work at IJ.org and all the rest of the really fantastic cases that IJ is involved in, fighting for economic liberty, personal liberty, all of that all over the country. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check us out online at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The left is continuing its effort to defund not only the police, but the entire U.S. justice system. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A few weeks ago, finally free from nearly a year of lockdown that canceled all my speaking engagements, I spoke to three groups across three consecutive evenings in Lexington, Louisville, and Indianapolis. The people were great, the interaction stimulating, fun, but I was struck at how our conversations touched on not just matters from COVID to the culture to politics, but on the social unrest in the streets the year before in those three cities and in others. That was particularly the case in Louisville, where the Breonna Taylor incident had taken place, which spilled protesters into the streets, many of them backing Black Lives Matter and demanding the defunding of police. There were also demonstrations in Lexington, a university town, and likewise, protests had shaken downtown Indianapolis. Of course, these three cities are all far from alone. For many of the protesters, defunding the police means precisely that, And for some, even that isn't enough. Some are even calling for abolishing the police and more. State's Patrice Cullors, the founder of Black Lives Matter, quote, "Abolition is the getting rid of police, prisons and jails, surveillance and courts," unquote. Yes, she says, abolition means just that, quote, "getting rid of police, prisons and jails, surveillance and courts." That's the founder of Black Lives Matter, and she's far from alone. BLM activist Miski Noor insists that when fellow activists say that they want to abolish the police, they, quote, 100% mean they want no more police, unquote. They pursued just that. Black Lives Matter, at its website under the hashtag defund the police, writes this: "We call for a national defunding of police." Under the tab, "What defunding the police really means," BLM leads with this outrageous claim. Are you ready? Listen, quote, "We know that police don't keep us safe," unquote. That's a direct quote from BLM's website. I'll say it again. "We know that police don't keep us safe." Of course, that's an alarming assertion that angers police, including black police, which are often the majority of the police in many big city police departments, as well as black residents in communities who feel that the police do keep them safe. Asked about defunding, David Clark, the former sheriff of Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, and African-American, states emphatically, quote, "The biggest losers in all of that would be poor black people in crime-ridden ghettos. The police are the only thing standing between them and violent criminal predators. You'd have to loathe black people to do that to them," unquote. Of course, cities that have cut police funding, like Portland and Seattle, have seen an explosion in crime and civil unrest, and the police feel embattled. That brings me back to one of my recent talks in the Midwest. I finished up in Indianapolis, where a former student of mine is a police officer. I'll call him Joe. Joe told me, quote, "As a police officer, I see firsthand the damage that Black Lives Matter is causing." Joe says he's suddenly facing suspicion and hostility from a black community that he worked hard to establish friendships with. His fellow police officers, many if not mostly black, jokingly call Joe the philosopher because he engages in philosophical, theological conversations with street guys, black and white. "I talk to them," Joe told me. "I treat them with dignity. I tell them I want to go home tonight and see my family, just like them. We talk about race. We talk about religion." He's worked hard to form bonds, but now it's getting harder. Joe told me, quote, "For the first time in my 15-plus year career, I feel I can understand what the soldiers returning from Vietnam experienced upon returning to a thankless country." All Joe wanted to be growing up was a policeman. While other students of mine went to law school or med school, Joe went to police school to learn how to chase down bad guys. He viewed police heroically, but now he feels helpless. Of course, don't get me wrong. I totally understand that there are abusive police. I've personally witnessed it. Friends of mine, white friends, have experienced police abuse. But you don't make the streets safer by defunding or abolishing the police. Bad police need to be stopped, but good police need to be defended. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WKGM-AM in Smithfield, Virginia, along with WMRN-FM and WYNT-FM in Marion, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.